everyone, and welcome to the Free Movement Monthly Podcast. This is your March roundup, and I'm your host, Sonia Lenigan. I am joined, as ever, by Colin Yeo. Colin, how are you doing? I think you've just had a lovely time away in Italy, haven't you?
I have. I was away for Easter, had a lovely time, back now, and slightly hay fevery. It's spring.
I'm so ready for spring. Anyway, on to everything that happened in March. We're starting off with asylum, and the first article we're looking at is Asylum Casework Inspection Report Reveals Mishandling of Cases, Secret Ministerial Directions. So this is where the Home Office published those 13 reports from the Independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration all on the same day after they'd sacked him. Luckily, I've had a proper look now, and they're not all relevant to us. For example, I think there's one on firearms, which I have no intention of reading, and more of them are going to be written up in due course, as the Home Office would say. But this is the big one. This one is really relevant. It's a very long report, and I was tempted to just review the key points, which are set out at length at the beginning of the report, and do my write-up from there. But I kept going, not least because Lizzie Dearden had WhatsApped me and said, hey, like, have you seen this in the report? It was in part 7, which I'll get to later. And I'm glad that I did, because there were some really shocking bits that were in the body of the report that weren't actually flagged up under key findings. Some of those bits that were extremely concerning. Apparently, there was a ministerial direction not to consult with stakeholders about the introduction of the streamlined process. And, you know, having been in roles previously where I have to go to these stakeholder meetings and try to engage with the Home Office, I do wonder how often that happens, that they're told specifically not to engage with NGOs. So that is something that I thought was quite interesting. The report also had withdrawal of asylum claims for non-return of the streamlining questionnaire when it had never been received. And again, we know this has been happening from people reporting it. And the person mentioned in the report was in Home Office accommodation, didn't receive the questionnaire, had their asylum claim withdrawn. The inspector also found cases where the invite to interview and failure to attend interviews were sent out on the same day, and that is cases plural. There were also issues with late delivery of biometric residence permits, and we know that that has been a relevant factor in the huge increase in newly recognised refugees being made street homeless just after they've been granted. Then the stuff on Albanians, it's horrifying to the point that even internally at the Home Office, concerns were raised about changes that had been made to the Albanian country policy information notes. Now, there is a separate report on that specific point, and I am going to read that and write it up as soon as possible. There was also a ministerial direction that no more than 2% of Albanian asylum claims could be successful, and decision makers were told not to implement grants even where the decision had been made. And as I mentioned in the article, that reminded me of what happened with that XY case that I wrote up a couple of months ago, where they were doing lots of secretive things about around trafficking cases. Anyway, every now and then I write an article and I'm like, everyone, you have to go and read this. And this is definitely one of those. I mean, obviously read all of it, but like really go read this one. And as I said at the beginning of the article, anyone who is working with Albanian clients should read all of Section 7 of the actual report. I think that's really, really important. And then that takes me very smoothly on to the other thing that you should be reading if you have Albanian clients, which is our article, How to Effectively Represent Albanian People Seeking Asylum in an Increasingly Difficult Environment. And I think I had commissioned this before this report came out. So before we knew things like the Home Office was being told to only allow 2% of Albanian asylum claims. So this article sets out how stark the different treatment is for Albanians. For example, they're the highest nationality in detention. And obviously now we know the Home Office is increasingly reluctant to grant them refugee status. So this article looks at how these cases can still be brought successfully. It points out that the appeal success rate is around 58%, and challenges to certification of Albanian cases as clearly unfounded also seem to do well. We've seen some reported decisions of those. And obviously that's judicial review work. So it's possible to recover costs from the Home Office, which is an important point for anyone doing legal aid. So I would just really encourage people to read this article and remember that, like, not to give up on Albanians, basically. And the article was written by Migrant and Refugee Children's Legal Unit, better known as MICLU, and they do amazing work with Albanians and have done for many years now, particularly young people. And they also work closely with Shpresa, which is a charity that works very closely with the Albanian community. So absolutely read those two articles, especially if you work with Albanians who are in the asylum system. Colin, that is on to you next.
Yeah, and before we move on, it's really hard to pick out the sort of most shocking bit of that report, isn't it? But for my money, it's the 2% directive. It's like, you know, unlawful fettering of discretion, anybody, you know, and sort of imposing for political reasons a directive on civil servants and officials, obviously in breach of the Refugee Convention. It's just so obviously wrong and unlawful. It's just absolutely incredible.
I do wonder if there's some sort of legal challenge happening around that, and that is actually the bit that Lizzie messaged me about and said, look at that paragraph. Yeah, it's just, I think that was the most shocking thing for me as well. But it was, like, reading that report, there were a lot of open-mouthed moments.
Yeah, it's certainly, if there isn't a generic challenge, I'm not sure how that would work, but it's, you know, in individual cases, you know, not everybody's entitled to asylum. Some people are going to lose, but you know, the fact that that directive was imposed surely gives you pretty strong grounds if you're trying to fight a clearly unfounded certificate and so on. So yeah
exactly, because how do you know that was a decision made on the merits and not on the basis of this ministerial direction that 98% of cases are rejected?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Okay. So moving on to the Ukraine scheme, just giving this a fairly quick mention. We've covered it on the blog fairly extensively, but basically there were some major changes to the various Ukraine schemes that allow people to enter. The Ukraine Family Scheme, as it's called, was scrapped entirely. The Homes for Ukraine scheme was maintained but amended. The people who can sponsor are now much narrower, so it's only people who are settled British or Irish. So it's much harder for Ukrainians to act as sponsors, although it's still open to them to try and find a British person or a settled person to act as a sponsor. The kind of administration of entering has become a lot harder for that reason as well, because, you know, you've got to go through all the sponsorship checks and all that kind of thing. And that was all announced with basically zero notice. So some pretty major changes there that make it a lot harder for Ukrainians to enter the UK. We're doing a seminar on the 15th of April. So you might be listening to that afterwards. If you're listening to it before, then, you know, do book on. You might be listening to it afterwards. We do have recordings available now. So if you go to the website and you go to the training pages, and you'll find there is a specific webinars page now under training, and that includes at least some of the previous webinars. What you don't get with those recordings is the question and answers. But if you've missed the webinar itself now, we do have a facility for you to do a sort of catch up, and you can buy those online from us. So that's the main Ukrainian things. And I think the next item we've got on the list is also one of mine to cover, which is two Hamid referrals. Now, Sonia, you wrote this up. You've done a very straight down the line factual account of this, which is the right way to deal with these.
I always try not to do a libel when I write these things.
Yeah, we do have to be a little bit careful about these things. They're pretty standard Hamid cases in some ways. Basically, it looks like injunctions being sought without full disclosure of the background. In both cases, the firms sort of formally behind the injunction applications don't seem to have been fully aware of what was going on. It looks like people who weren't necessarily formally authorized sort of putting in these applications, they look like they're probably sort of immigration non-specialists. But if you want to read the background, have a look at Sonia's write-up. It's called Two Hamid Referrals Made in Asylum Cases Where Out-of-Hours Injunctions Were Sought. Also, obviously, that's got links through to the full judgments and facts. And it's really a very useful reminder that if you are doing out-of-hours injunctions, directions, you need to be very careful about what you are doing. You need to make sure that you really fully disclose the background, and it is not a kind of application to be lightly made at all. So yeah, do read that as a salutary reminder of how important it is to get these things right and to be very careful. And also, it'd be remiss of me not to plug, for quite a long time now, we've had training available online on how to do this. It's an interview that I think I conducted with Jared Lukmani years ago now that's still available there. The audio for that is still there. And I'd highly recommend it if you're starting to get into that kind of work or you're thinking about doing that kind of work.
Yeah, I think I also included a link in there to our online training on judicial reviews that was done by Jed Pennington and Gabriel Tan and is just excellent. Like, everyone should do it. If you're doing judicial review work, it's a really useful refresher. But I linked directly to the bit on out-of-hours injunctions as well. So if people don't have time to do the whole thing, I would recommend just a little refresh on that. Next one is mine. And this is government legal department told by High Court to keep rather basic point in mind when advising on redactions. This is the latest installment of the government's battle to keep junior civil servants' names out of disclosed documents. This is an issue as it makes understanding disclosure more difficult when you can't tell who is doing or saying what because it's just full of black squares. The Home Office has been told by the High Court and they've been told by the Court of Appeal that they cannot do this, and yet they are still asking it regardless. And this case is Swift telling the government legal department directly this time, essentially to sort themselves out and to stop doing this. We'll see whether or not they do it. But it does seem like all these cases are ending up with Swift and that he is, oh, do I say swiftly losing patience? Oh, look, I did. So
too late.
They really, I'm really, really sorry, everyone. And yeah, so they need to change their practice, or they have been told previously the alternative is to change the law, but they can't just keep trying to get around it. The next case I am just briefly mentioning because it is super niche. This is Special Immigration Appeals Commission has the power to award costs in reviews. So essentially, there is case law saying that for appeals, costs cannot be awarded in SIAC. But this case said that where it is a review under Section 2D4, which deals with review of certain naturalization and citizenship decisions, then yes, it is possible to recover costs. And that is just using judicial review principles, essentially. If you are interested in this, I do find cost cases interesting generally. I suppose I eventually found this one interesting, but it took me a while to figure out exactly what was going on because I've never dealt with SIAC cases before. If you do, go read that. Next, we are on to points-based system, whatever we're calling it nowadays. So this is Statement of Changes, HC 590, salary thresholds increased, shortage occupation list gone. And then also, the second article is changes to work visa routes from 4 April 2024 and what it means for employers. The main changes with this most recent statement of changes are that shortage occupation list is gone and it's replaced with appendix immigration salary list. And then, of course, this is the statement of changes that raised the minimum income threshold for skilled workers to 38,700 from the 4th of April. Also, of course, as we all know, because we're recording this on the 12th of April, the day after it came into effect, the minimum income requirement for partner applications under Appendix FM has gone up to £29,000. The second article I mentioned, that is a more in-depth look at the changes to skilled worker and other business routes. So it looks at changes to global business mobility routes, scale-up routes, the transitional provisions around certificates of sponsorship. Some of that is in the past now because it was to do with what was happening with the system as it was being changed over. But a lot of that is still relevant because it's to do with where the certificates were allocated before the 4th of April. Anyway, go have a look at that. And it also looks at changes to health and care visas. And there is a lot on what employers need to be aware of with the changes to the skilled worker routes. And I would just say that that second article was wildly popular in the weeks between it being published leading up to the changes. And it's obviously still really useful for anyone who hasn't had to actually look at what's changed yet.
Thanks, Sonia. And now for something completely different from me, we'll talk about a case involving tagging. So this is, it's a really interesting case. I think a really, really pretty shocking set of facts. The blog post title is Court Finds That Home Office's Imposition of a GPS Tag Was Unlawful for Over a Year in First Case of Its Kind. It's by Katie Schwartzman, who I think is at Wilson's Solicitors. And it's the facts are that the man behind this, Mr. Nelson, he at the time of the hearing had been wearing a tag, one of these GPS tags, as in it tracks your location somewhat inaccurately. There are question marks about how accurate it even is. And he'd been wearing it for 18 months and it emerged on the, I think on the first day of the hearing, it'd been broken for 6 months, basically. So he'd suspected it had been broken for a long time. Home Office insisted that it hadn't been, insisted that he carried on wearing it. And this is a guy who, it's not as if he has tenuous connections to the UK. So father of five, qualified car mechanic, UK resident for 24 years. And his argument in this case is that the imposition of the tag was a breach of his human rights, an interference with his Article 8 ECHR rights. There have been quite a few of these tagging challenges. And the problem is that all of them get conceded. So I've seen some sort of chat behind the scenes from various people who've been involved in these as well. Basically, you bring a challenge and the Home Office concedes it very quickly. They didn't in this case. So it actually did go to trial, so to speak. And it found that there was this kind of automatic assumption that you had to keep on wearing the tag was unlawful, didn't win on whether it was unlawful to impose the tag in the first place. And what Katie says in the blog post is that he's hoping to appeal that to the Court of Appeal. And she also draws in the Information Commissioner's Office's recent pronouncement, basically, that the Home Office's use of people's data under the tagging scheme was unlawful. Because it's sort of one of my ongoing themes is the Home Office needs saving from itself. And this is a good example of it where, they're at considerable expense to the taxpayer. They're routinely issuing these tags to collect a huge amount of data and they don't do anything with it. They don't even need it. It's massively intrusive potentially because they say they might access it in some cases. So for example, if you claim that you've been visiting, what Katie's written in the blog post, if you claim you've been visiting your partner in hospital or something, they could easily check whether that's true, they say, by looking at the location data and seeing if it sort of matches up with what you're saying. But there's no evidence, I think, that they actually have ever accessed that information. They're just kind of gathering it. It's being stored. And sometimes it's not even being gathered. As this case shows, the tag was actually broken. It wasn't gathering data. They insisted that he carried on wearing it. It's just absolutely incredible. So it's these kind of cases are ripe for legal challenge. This is a very helpful precedent. And watch this space. It may go further. It may go up to the Court of Appeal as well. So very interesting case. The next case we're covering is also one from me. This is actually by Nick Nason, one of our regular contributors, often helps us out with deportation stuff. The title is Can a Stateless Person Be Subject to Deportation Proceedings? And it's one of those questions that the answer is obvious as soon as you start to think about it. Because, and this is one of the things where kind of knee-jerk politicians, people who haven't thought about it, think, oh, well, all these asylum seekers arriving in small boats, let's just send them off to France or something. It's like, well, you can't do that because the French won't agree to it. You'd have to invade their country, invade their territorial waters to do that. Well, it's the same sort of issue that arises with can a stateless person be subject to deportation proceedings. Where are you going to deport them? If they don't have another nationality, what country can you actually deport them to? So that's the sort of basic issue here. And arguably slightly surprising in that context, the court concludes, and there's a kind of high court judgment and a court of appeal judgment, both of which are linked from Nick's post here. The court concludes that the deportation proceedings aren't inherently unlawful in this situation. The facts of the case show the kind of issues that arise here. He was born in the UK, but he wasn't a British citizen because it was after the 1st of January 1983. His parents were Ugandan. The Home Office attempted to remove him to Uganda, and the Ugandan authorities basically said, no, we're not taking him. We're not convinced he's Ugandan. They questioned the British approach to basically offloading foreign criminals to other countries, consider themselves to be used as a dumping ground for criminals who've been raised in the UK, which is a point that a lot of us have been raising about these cases for a long time now. And clearly it's not an academic issue. It's something that the authorities themselves in Uganda were conscious of here. And so in the end, that attempt to deport him to a country that the authorities didn't accept he was from failed. But, it's quite salutary to think that the Home Office even attempted that in this case. And there's no substantive finding, actually, as Nick says. This wasn't about whether it was whether the deportation decision was substantively right on the merits. It was really about just the lawfulness of the proceedings at all from that point of view. So interesting case again, pretty shocking set of facts. And I think you are covering the next one, aren't you, Sonia?
This is the latest in the Akinsanya litigation, which is really, really important. I just found the decision quite difficult read because I don't love all this EU law stuff. It's not something I've ever spent much time doing, so I always struggle with these sorts of decisions. Anyway, the article is Akinsanya Latest, Guidance on Zambrano Carers Found to Be Unlawful, Appendix EU Unaffected. So I think that was part of my struggle with this, because it's really unclear as to whether anything is actually going to change as a result of this decision. So I'm not going to go into the details of the judgment. If you want to, you can read my write-up, or if you really love EU law, go and read the full thing. But essentially, this is the latest installment of the long-running litigation, which, when it comes down to it is about the exclusion of mainly single mothers of British citizen children from being able to access leave under Appendix EU, which is much more beneficial than Appendix FM in a number of ways, not least because you avoid the increasingly extortionate application fees. So the actual decision aside, I just find it so outrageous the lengths that the Home Office has gone to with this to screw these people over, essentially.
And what do they expect?
And for what?
Exactly,
I mean, yeah. they're not going anywhere.
That's it. They're just going to end up being unlawfully resident and their kids as well. And it's not as if there's some sort of deterrent effect, you know, because this route is closed now. You can't qualify now because EU law no longer applies. It's only people who are already here and everything. It's just, again, Home Office needs saving from themselves.
It just makes life more unpleasant.
Yeah.
For single mothers of British citizen children. Like, what is the policy aim here? Anyway, this is something that I could rant about for ages, but I'm not going to. I've got a dedicated rant coming up, so, you know, watch this space. Well,
we look forward to that.
No, it's in this podcast. It's on my next item.
Excellent. Well, I'll quickly skip over the next two cases fairly quickly then, I think. So I've got two cases to cover on citizenship. It's not often you can say there's sort of two citizenship cases in 1 month. One of them I think I can deal with pretty briefly because I'm just not going to go back into the background. So this is the Roehrig case, spelled Roehrig. The blog post title is Roehrig Upheld by Court of Appeal, No Changes for Certain Children of EU Citizens Not Entitled to British Citizenship. And I can either go deep on this and explain all the background or just skip over it lightly. I'm choosing the latter option. I'm a coward. Because basically, we've covered this fairly extensively. The other case, this is quite an interesting one, although it's pretty unusual on the facts. I'll deal with this one fairly briefly as well. Appellant keeps British nationality after Court of Appeal overturns dishonesty finding. So this is a case where somebody applied for British citizenship and pleaded guilty to what looks like a dishonesty offence very shortly afterwards. So the Home Office said, well, you must have known, I'm not sure they've quite put it like this, but essentially their case was, you must have known that you'd been involved in this dishonesty type offence beforehand, and therefore you were guilty of deception in not declaring it. But what happens here is the Court of Appeal really drills down into whether it really was a dishonesty offence or not. And they say, well, look, you don't need the mens rea of the offence. You don't need to have been dishonest for you to have been convicted here and to have pleaded guilty. And also, importantly, the Home Office hasn't really put that to you. So this guy could have been cross-examined on any number of different occasions by a HOPO saying, yeah, but actually you must have known. And they just never did. They never put it to him. So because of that failure to put the case, because of that lack of cross-examination, and because the offence technically doesn't inherently require deception, he was able to get away with it. So yeah, it's an interesting example of quite a strict approach basically being adopted to a criminal offence. And you know, that strict approach hadn't been adopted by the upper tribunal previously. This was the Court of Appeal overturning an upper tribunal decision. So it's quite interesting on the facts. It's not likely to come up very often, but it is nevertheless quite an important case on deception and quite a sort of limiting case from that point of view. So useful. Okay, Sonia, you've teased a rant. Go on.
No, just to say, I also found that case really interesting. And that article I have spoken about to a few people and said, oh, like, have you read this one? It's really interesting, even though I don't ordinarily find British nationality cases that interesting either. Right. So the final one we're going to talk about, which, you know, contains my rant as trailed, is more increases to application fees, including passports and Appendix FM. So passport fees went up this week. We are recording on Friday, the 12th of April. I think they went up a couple of days ago. And the thing that I want to rant about is the new Hong Kong fee waiver process. I have written about it separately, but because it's so recent while we're recording this, I'm going to do my rant now rather than next month. The changes were announced in these regulations, and essentially there was no fee waiver process set out before now for extending leave under Appendix Hong Kong BNO. And so when I first saw this, I was like, oh, great, fee waiver process. That's a useful thing to have. And then, so the first line is you need to have the no recourse to public funds restriction lifted from your leave. And I was like, oh, great. Like maybe if you have the NRPF lifted, the condition lifted, then you can get your fee waiver. What a good idea. And then I got to the next line. It was like, you have to be in receipt of public funds. And I was like, oh, okay. But also, like, I guess if you're in receipt of public funds and you can automatically get your fee waiver, great. That sounds useful. But then after that, it's the affordability test as well. So actually, they've put in place this wildly restrictive fee waiver policy, whereby first you have to have had the no recourse to public funds condition lifted from your leave. Then you need to be in receipt of public funds. And then you have to convince the Home Office that you meet the affordability test. Why that third step exists after you have done those first two things is completely and utterly beyond me. But yeah, it's just, I encountered someone who was affected by this within days of these regulations being laid. That article that I mentioned that I published this week is actually adapted from a pre-action letter that I've sent about these regulations. But it's really, this is something that is going to be very difficult to challenge, which is what I put in my article this week as well, because ordinarily, what happens if someone is applying for an extension of their leave? If your fee waiver application is rejected, you have, I think it's 10 days to put in another application so that you can keep your Section 3C leave. And that means that you can keep your leave while your application is being considered and decided. If you don't get that application in within the 10 days, then you lose everything. You lose your right to work, your right to rent, you lose your ability to live a life relatively unaffected by the hostile environment. And I'm certainly not saying that holding Section 3C leave is a dream. But that's why it's really difficult to challenge this sort of thing, because how do you protect someone's Section 3C leave? So I mean, I have some ideas of how this can be done, but I'm not going to set that all out in the article. I'm sure people who are experienced in these matters can also think of ways that this can be challenged. But why are we even here? We were talking earlier, what is the policy aim here? What is the policy aim with this? And I know, Colin, you did a thread yesterday speculating.
Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it? Because I mean, if you think about it, so either... Because I can understand charging big fees for people to come in. I don't agree with it, but you know, either they come or they don't, and you know that's one thing. But once people are here, if you charge really big fees and you don't have a fee waiver if they can't afford it, then basically you're either forcing them out of the country or forcing them to live here without status or forcing them to claim asylum. And so, well, how are any of those outcomes good outcomes? So it's just, it seems such a bad idea, really. And yeah, and how far it's deliberate, how far it's kind of just haven't thought it through, and what are they trying to achieve with this? So again, it's another installment of Home Office needs saving from itself.
This is why I genuinely thought I was going mad. I was like, I must be missing something. Like, this is so stupid and bad. Like, surely not. And, you know, one of the big issues with this, one of, not the only, but it's the fact that these things take time. It's quite common now that a change of conditions application to have the no recourse to public funds restriction lifted can take months easily. Bad decisions are made, administrative reviews need to go in. And then once you've gone through that months-long process, you then need to apply for benefits. That is also not immediate. So it's difficult to see. I think anyone in at least the last 6 months of their leave is going to struggle to access this process, this fee waiver process. And it's just, yeah, it's just completely and utterly wild to me as to why they have done it like this. Yeah, I'm baffled. I'm baffled. And I mean, surely it's not going to last too long. I can't see how it sustains any form of legal challenge. But as I said, the issue is going to be getting that legal challenge up and running. Anyway, that's my rant.
That's a spectacular fail from us for ending on a good note, isn't it?
I've got more bad news to end on, which is the other thing I wanted to flag up from this article, the application fees article, is that on the 24th of July this year, in-country applications made under Appendix FM will increase, I think it's around 20%, from £1,048 to £1,258. So that is just a date that people need to get in their heads now. And obviously, we need to get applications in for clients before then, where possible.
And to make it even worse, I think that we can expect more of these fee hikes in the future, because if the Home Office succeeds in reducing the number of people entering the UK, which is obviously their sort of stated aim at the moment, and they've adopted various different measures to actually make it happen this time, that's less immigration fees being paid. And the Home Office is hugely, hugely dependent on the income from those fees now. So it's going to have less income and it's going to need to make up that shortfall. So, you know, got a very bad feeling that we might be looking at some really substantial future increases too.
Yep. No, ending on good news today. Sorry, everyone. But it is getting increasingly difficult to find anything positive to end on. And obviously next week we are facing the Rwanda bill back in Parliament. So I don't think things are going to improve anytime soon.
And so with on that note,
sorry.
Your cheerful co-hosts for the Free Room podcast will sign off. So goodbye, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. We will catch you next month. Bye.